Undisciplined is a collaboration between African and African-American studies at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
The podcast provides a peek into the complex issues that affects our interconnected world.
Taking the interdisciplinary approach of African and African-American studies to the classroom, into the community, onto the airwaves, and beyond. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton, and for this sixth season, I have a new co-host,
Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get into it. Today, we are having a very important conversation. I think one that has been happening around the globe that we've even seen reflected in films. Did you watch The Black Panther, Anthony?
Okay, so I still haven't seen The Black Panther, but yes. I know what it's about.
Okay, so in The Black Panther, you see in one of the first scene, the Michael B. Jordan character, he is in the British Museum and he's looking at artifacts and he encounters some African artifacts and he has this dialogue with the curator and, you know, kind of chastises her a little bit about them being stolen from Africa and that they needed to be repatriated, and he takes the mask, and then the whole thing ensues.
I want to know, was that in the first one or the second one?
Oh, my goodness.
There's a reason why I'm asking the first one, which is interested us in there because the government of Ghana actually sued the producers of Black Panther.
Really?
Because they had Kente in the movie and did not indicate that it's specifically from Ghana.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that's trademarked.
It's in copyright. It's called a geographical location.
Ah, yeah. I see. But that's what, you know, we get off museum in the media. That's one of the instances. I mean, we've seen numerous films. You know, I'm a fan of those Brendan Fraser films where we see, you know, the museum on full display. But believe it or not, also, I frequently, you know, as director of African-American studies, I get contacted by people all the while, you know, having memorabilia. Where should I send them? Where can I come and put them with you, you know? People talking about the, you know, properly storing items from their grandmother's possessions after they pass away, or their dad inherited things, ceramic figurines, you know, some of them depicting racist caricatures of Black people some of the times. People who have collected African art or any other kind of art, and they want to, reach out because they don't want to destroy them without first contacting someone who is an expert on African-American or African culture to donate these so they could be beneficial to our history, right, for them to be preserved. And luckily, we have someone who is an expert, who has studied this, knows all the things and what the goings-ons in such places today with us, a member of the university museum who has extensive knowledge on maintaining the collections from different fields, whether it's from archaeology, ethnography, geology, history, zoology, all available at the university museum for exhibition, research, education, and for loan. Who we're talking about today, Tony, is Miss Laurel Lamb.
Welcome, Miss Laura.
Thank you for having me here today.
Welcome to the Undisciplined Podcast.
Yeah. Thank you.
I am very familiar with Miss Laurel. She's given presentations for the African and African American Studies program before, and she recently did a presentation in my Intro to African and African American Studies class.
Wow. What was that presentation about?
Well, we're going to get to it in a second.
All right.
All right. Miss Lamb is very passionate about museum collections and sharing them with those who are eager to learn. She does many of these presentations, so we're just hoping that she can help to enlighten the public more about what the museum has so that, you know, they can take their children or students themselves can go and see these collections, do research. And because, of course, we are an undisciplined program, we're interdisciplinary, it's very important for students to know about the objects, you know, as a historian, I look in the archives, but right, archaeology and anthropology and ethnography and all of these different fields, which are also very much a part of African and African-American studies, are also the museum is very important in that regard.
I want to start by asking there something, right? Sure. I noticed that you have a master's in like heritage preservation. I'm curious how someone gets into wanting to make that their choice for school.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, for me, I originally really enjoyed my history classes, and I enjoyed learning about people. Mm-hmm. I never, when I was growing up, I didn't think, oh, I want to work in a museum. It sounds kind of casual, but it just kind of happened that way. I started interning when I was in college at different museum collections, and it just kind of became a passion of mine as I grew up and went through school, I guess. Yeah. So happens differently for everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there a specific thing you were doing during your internship that made you feel like, okay, I could make this a lifetime work?
I mean, I think there is this part of what interests me is when you're working with these tangible history materials that connect you with people from all over time and all over the world. It takes you out of wherever you're living that particular time frame and helps put you in the footsteps of somebody else. And I think that was one of the things that really interested me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting way of putting it. Yeah, something tangible that connects you to history. I never thought about it like that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, I think about it, you might see an object in a museum, and it could, for instance, be a chair.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. But it tells you about even the forest.
Yeah.
It tells you, what kind of chair is it?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a stool, for instance, that suggests some kind of a power that is connected to, like, a chief in Ghana?
Yeah.
Or was it an emperor's chair that conveys power?
Yeah.
You know, what kind of things it might be made with? So
when you mentioned that, I just remember that when I used to go to the museum with my dad when I was in Ghana a lot, right? And we went to the military museum once, and we saw a hat. It was just a hat, right? And it's just like a normal hat anywhere. And I'm like, what is this hat? And then there were like Ghanaians who fought in the World War II. Whenever they went to a particular place, they would get something from there. And sometimes it would just be a hat that maybe would be from the British soldier. But because they found it in maybe Burma or anywhere, they used to fight in Asia. That hat represented that place that they fought in. So it's just a hat, but in the museum, it represents the history of Ghanaian soldiers fighting in World War II for a side they didn't even believe in.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the other thing about that is that's really interesting is that how object meaning changes inside of a museum, outside of a museum, and just even person to person. You know, your perspective on the object might be really different than mine or from yours, and so I think that interpretation of object is really interesting and really important too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reference I was making just now about, you know, thinking about the commodities involved in the making of an object, you know, it's a chair, but if it's not a chair, what is it? It's not a chair, it's a tree, right? It is a tree because it's a product of its environment. This chair is made from a tree. It's made of oak, solid oak. In addition, the chair's form invokes a tree. Uh-huh. The trunk, the branches, all these acorns, and these carvings, which looks like a wood grain. The chair is from Connecticut in the 1680s, a time when Americans relied heavily upon trees. Trees formed an important part of the New England economy. They were a resource that was more readily available in New England than in Europe, which was largely deforested. Not only did the New England economy rely upon trees, but people relied upon them in everyday life for houses, for fire to keep warm, for furniture. The chair symbolizes the reliance on natural resources. This is not a chair, it's a commodity. A chair like this was not only beautiful, but it was required It has also required a vast network of commercial relationships to create it. It required a craftsman to produce it, many different sources for the materials that made it. A particular piece of importance is the mahogany. The mahogany might have been harvested in Brazil by slaves, transported across the Atlantic to where it was produced, and it was also very expensive. A purchaser of this chair would have not only been trying to purchase something that was beautiful to join their house, but also something that retained value, that could be traded and sold when financial times were less than ideal. This is not a chair. It's a symbol of power, right? We can look at the chair from the standpoint of anthropology. This chair is a symbol of patriarchal authority. On the American frontier in the 17th and 18th century, chairs were scarce. Most people sat on boxes or barrels or benches. The only chair in the house belonged to the head of the household, the patriarch. The chair's form shows the patriarch's dominion over the domestic sphere. It's a massive size, and regal arms both symbolize the patriarch's authority. And then this is not a chair. This is a document.
Yeah.
In this case, it's a document of slavery. In the early 19th century, Thomas Jefferson commissioned this Campeche chair to be made by one of his slaves for him. This chair was built by John Hemmings, Sally Hemmings' brother, and one of Tom Jefferson's master furniture makers at Monticello. Jefferson commissioned this chair to be made in order to relieve his rheumatoid arthritis. Hemmings' labor was literally used for Jefferson's own comfort, and this chair served as a document of that relationship. This is not a chair, this is a treatment. I could go on forever.
Yeah.
Right? But this is one scholar's take on such an object that one might encounter in a museum. Right, and how scholars might interpret that from an undisciplined and multidisciplinary perspective. Yeah. Can you tell us the kinds of collection that we might find in the University of Arkansas Museum?
Sure, yeah. So our museums, I think you mentioned a bit about some of our collections earlier, but so it started back in the 1870s, to keep it short, basically. Our history goes back to the 1870s, about the same time the university formed. Mm-hmm. We originally started as a geology teaching collection. Mm. And over the years, it expanded to zoology collections with animal specimens, and then local history, regional history, coming from archaeology collections. And then because we're a university museum, and a lot of these collections are coming from people associated with university, faculty, alumni, students, there's a lot of people who come in with international collections as well, and so we also have international collections from around the world, cultural collections from around the world, and so it's a pretty varied collection. I've heard someone describe us as encyclopedic, so it's pretty varied, but I think in some ways it can be kind of overwhelming when you first learn about it, because there's so much to explore, but I think in other ways it's really interesting because you can study one particular artifact or you can connect multiple artifacts that you wouldn't necessarily connect otherwise because they're in that same space.
Right. So. Wonderful.
So when it comes to like a museum, how do you fund what you do? Where your money comes from, what your donors and stuff like that?
Where the artifacts come from?
Yeah.
So, a lot of them, again, there's usually some sort of tie to UA, whether it's alumni or faculty members. It usually comes back to UA, and I would say that, again, kind of going back, we've had a long history, and our collecting practices have changed over the years, like. I would hope all museums over time by now have changed in their ways. And so...
Can you mention the ways in which the collection process have changed?
Yeah. So, for instance, our museum in the past did more purchasing of artifacts. And today, we really only take in things when someone reaches out and donates them. So that's one particular way. So that means we don't take in nearly as much as we used to. And I think we also are a lot more selective in what we take in. We want to make sure that we know where things are coming from, that they have context. And I think context and knowing where things come from is really important today. I mean, for a lot of reasons, but I know we're potentially going to talk about repatriation later, but also just in general, when we have people who reach out to us wanting to study the collections, the more we already know about an object, the more helpful it will be.
Yeah.
I mean, we always hope that when researchers come to us and want to work with the collections, that they're going to provide even more insight about those objects, but we'd hope we can provide them with something about the object already as well, if that makes sense.
At least something that will point them towards where they should look for their research.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have situated here in the South, right? We know you have interesting collections, especially as it relates to African Americans. Can you speak to those, and we can get into some of the interesting collections and objects that you have that, you know, the listeners might be interested to hear about?
Sure. Yeah, I think probably the ones that I share the most about and I know the most about are our Bell dolls,
mm-hmm.
Which I have talked about in your classes before. The Bell dolls were created by Ida Roberta Bell back in the 60s and 70s. She was a Chicago school teacher, and she originally created these dolls as teaching aids for her students to teach them about African American history. And then when she retired, she became a full-time doll artist. And so all these dolls were handmade by her. And she was influenced by her father, who was a sculptor. So she learned these skills pretty early on. It's a set of 26 dolls. We have all of the dolls. And they each represent a different figure in African American in history, who made an impact in history.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, there are a lot of things. They're a work of art. They're a teaching tool. And they're some of my favorites because she puts so much time and research into these dolls to make sure that they are accurate to the people they're representing. And I know something that we talked about in whenever I visited your class was representation matters. And
yes.
So that's why I think this collection is really special. And I did some research on other dolls that came from this time period. For instance, Baby Nancy came around in the 60s, and Black Barbie. They mm-hmm. all sort of came around during this time period with the civil rights movement. And there's a lot of experimentation trying to move away from stereotypical dolls that were just, I think they were just white dolls that they made black, basically trying to provide more representation. And so that's a collection that I really like to share with people.
Yeah. And that's a very important one because we just came out of Barbie, the excitement and pandemonium surrounding that. And then Black Barbie is actually going to come out soon as a documentary.
Oh,
yes, that centers black women and girls and reminding black women and girls of their beauty, right? And so it's been acquired by Netflix and Shondaland, so it's being produced by Shonda Rhimes.
Then
and
I'll
we know
it.
That there was a collection of Black Barbie that kind of emerged during that time. But the context for listeners to understand here is why the Bell dolls might have emerged. What would have prompted someone to kind of create those dolls and that kind of a representation?
Yeah.
And
why it mattered, especially in the 1960s when there was a lot of conversation around civil rights.
And the kind of conversation we had in class was Drs. Kenneth and Mamie Clark, then the famous doll tests. Have you heard about the doll test, Tony?
Yeah, I think that I watched a documentary on it.
Oh, really?
There's a documentary called, is it called Dark Girls? Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I watched it in 2015.
Okay. Yeah. So in the 1940s, the psychologists Kenneth and Mamie Clark designed and conducted a series of experiments that came to be known as the doll test to study the psychological effects of segregation on African-American children.
Mm-hmm.
And they used dolls. They used four dolls identical except for color to test the children's racial perceptions, right? The children were the subjects, and they were between the ages of 3 and 7 and were being asked to identify both the race of the dolls and which color doll they preferred, right? A majority of the children, of course, preferred the white doll and assigned positive characteristics to it. And the Clarks concluded that prejudice, discrimination, and segregation created a feeling of inferiority among African-American children that damaged their self-esteem. So this is like internalized hatred, right? Yeah. And so the doll test then became one part of the Clarks' testimony in the Brown versus Board of Education that ultimately overturned Jim Crow segregation and segregation in schools, right? You know, he, you know, did some of his analysis from it, and his expert report and testimony, you know, was considered cutting-edge psychological scholarship during that period, right? So he was trying to, you know, see the development of self-esteem in children and black children, and to see the extent to which their color, their sense of their own race and status influenced their judgment and, you know, about themselves and their self-esteem. So, I mean, we've heard this now of, you know, people wonder why is it that black people have this and black people have that. It goes to show what is the psychological connection. If you're not reading books with black characters in them, right, or seeing images of your famous figures, or imagining, like you see, of Black Panther, black people as superheroes, right?
Then you Black Panther is very important for the African American community over here.
Yeah, we create these kinds of, you know, ideas around our self-esteem that might be detriment to ourselves and our community. So that a collection of those dolls exist in the museum is very significant. And the students in my class got a chance to hear about that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in contrast to that, we also we have other dolls in the collections, including ones like a stereotypical mammy and a topsy-turvy doll. And I think what's important, one of the important things about those is that when we talk about those, when, for instance, when a class visits or whenever I talk with your class, we always talk about them together with the Bell dolls to understand why, to help understand the significance and why the Bell dolls are so important and not just focusing on one or the other.
That makes sense. And talk more on the representation. Outside of the United States, do you have collections from Africa and other places?
Yeah. Can she finish up the African-American first before we get...
I thought she had finished again,
Well, that's not all you have of African-Americans, right?
No, not necessarily. We can, I mean, we can also talk a little bit about, you reached out back in August and actually shared, talking about people reaching out to you about memorabilia they have in their houses. That did happen with us. You reached out and connected the museum with a person whose relatives had this racist memorabilia, and we connected with her and kind of talked about taking in these materials. And so it's another example of they can be used to teach about the past, so the past is not forgotten, but in the appropriate context, and why it's significant to hold on to something like that. So I know that the person who reached out had struggled with. I mean, I don't want them. Maybe I should throw them away, but then I don't want it to be forgotten about either. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing she had brought up.
I think that's very interesting, and I'm sure many people do have that kind of a struggle about, you know, this makes me feel some kind of a feeling that I'm connected to this. This is my heirloom, and this might not be a representation of myself or my family now, and perceptions might have changed. And I want to do my due diligence of, like, contributing into a place where people might be educated around it. So, you know, that was very bold and brave and courageous of that person. Yes.
So, should we? Okay, so I want to talk about some of the international collections you have from Africa and other places.
Yeah. So we do have some pieces from Africa, from various countries in Africa. Probably the most, the largest we have would be from Nigeria and Ghana, actually. And
I'm from Ghana.
Yeah, I remember when you're talking about that, I was like, yeah, there's probably some things that might interest you or you could tell us more about. Yeah, and there's actually, do you know Janine Sitsma?
Yes, in
yes.
art.
Yes, in
yeah,
art.
Yeah, she actually did have, Janine had a display a while back,
yeah.
right, with the university's museum ethnology collection, you know, did mm-hmm. some picking for that exhibit. Over 35,000 historical and contemporary objects from cultures all over the world, especially from Africa, were part of the exhibit. And I believe during that semester, students were introduced to some of the challenges inherent mm-hmm. in the exhibition of African art, which is especially a specialty of Dr. Sitsima. Right, and so she was able to mm-hmm. work with you, I believe.
Yeah, so we do. We work with classes on campus to do exhibits mm-hmm. occasionally when the professor is interested in doing that. And so we did work with her class, and they exhibited at the Fayetteville Public Library last, mm-hmm. or this past spring, I guess. I'm already thinking into 2024. and most of those pieces were from Ghana and Nigeria. And actually, there's someone in the community who was in the Peace Corps during the 60s, and so she lived in Nigeria, and this is where most of those collections are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And so, talking about the context of like how did those pieces come over from
yeah.
those countries to here? A lot of those collections, when it comes down to it, it's an American who lived overseas at some point and collected these pieces as souvenirs while they were living there.
Oh.
And then brought them back, and then later they end up at the museum. They're cleaning their houses out, or their relatives are cleaning their houses out, and then they end up there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Are there some from those collections that you find particularly exciting or stood out to you?
Yeah. So some of these actually have not been studied much by students yet, but I hope they do. There's some really interesting textiles there.
Yeah.
Some really beautiful textiles that students have taken an interest in, but we weren't able to exhibit them in the spring. There is also some calabash bowls.
Oh, nice.
Mm,
with some really beautiful designs on them as well. Those are a couple that stand out to mind right now.
Yeah. Textiles are a big part of the culture in both mm-hmm. Ghana and Nigeria, right? Which textile you wear is always a statement of class, right?
Sure.
So I'm sure if somebody from Ghana, I'm not very good with textiles differentiation in terms of the class,
mm-hmm.
but I'm pretty sure there are people who can explain to you the history behind each textile and its class relation. The ones that notify royalty, I'm very familiar with because mm-hmm. that's what my family typically will be using. But outside of that, I'm sure there are some ones that I don't know the history behind. So, for example, the most popular fabric in Ghana is called Fatia Fata Nkrumah. Nkrumah is the first president of Ghana, and his wife is called Fatia. And the word Fata means deserve, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the meaning of that fabric is Fatia deserves Nkrumah. That's because Fatia is not Ghanaian, right? She was from Egypt, and then Nkrumah was already president of Ghana when he married a woman from Egypt.
Mm.
So that was like his way of communicating to Ghanaians that all of us in Africa are the same or are one, right?
Mm.
And a lot of the Ghanaian women bought into that, and it went on to become some of the most popular fabric till date. Yeah, so there's always a lot of stories behind why some fabric, which may be just a design, but have a meaning behind it just
yeah.
beyond the design.
Wow.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, too, about...
Along the same lines, too, the fabrics also tell a very interesting story because a lot of the fabrics that we think are African are actually from Europe. Right,
yes.
They came there during the slave trade
yes,
from
sometimes,
the
yeah.
Netherlands and
yeah.
Other places, but it has been,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
No.
But the story behind that is a bit complicated because they may be owned by Netherlands companies,
mm-hmm.
but they are designed by Africans. So, like in Ghana, the biggest fabric company is owned by the Dutch government or the Dutch companies, right? Mm-hmm. But the designers are Ghanaians. They designed it and the Dutch own it. So I remember when Ghana was having energy issues, the Dutch government was supporting the textile companies in Ghana, right? That's because Ghanaian designers would design the fabric. The Dutch government would sell maybe 5,000 wads in Ghana and then mass produce it and sell it in other countries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so even though it may be Dutch owned, it still has some history.
They were introduced by Dutch merchants during the slave trade period, and that became a kind of currency during that period.
Yeah.
So it the kind of designs, what we see, you know, is Ankara, and we specifically attach it
Ankara is Nigerian.
You know, to Africa, you know, has this very long transatlantic history that is very fascinating. I know that some of the big collections, I work on Liberia, so I know that Kenneth Orr, who was a professor in anthropology back in the day, made some contributions to the African collections there, particularly pottery, right? The pottery collections. I have a note here from 1968, May 14th, in 1968, when he was a professor of anthropology. And, you know, he writes this note that I made a collection of Liberian pottery during my tour of duty with the United States Foreign Service.
Wow.
Between 1960 and 64, the collection was made in my spare time and was not connected with my duty assignment, except it contributed to an understanding of the historical anthropology of the area. I believe my efforts during this time represented the first interest shown in the archaeology of the nation. The material then seems important as a pioneer effort in opening up a field which promises to be a rich one for the future. And so he lists all the materials he collected in terms of ceramics, clay from the Liberian hinterland, from the Loma tribe, a cooking pot encased in a special basket made by the tribal people. Then from a different chiefdom, the Bush Basa tribe, from the Pele tribe, you know, a large rice bowl with a knob lid secured during 1963, probably from the Maino tribe. So it's very interesting, these kinds of collections that they were able to develop at that time.
And are they in there? Are those some of those in the museum?
Ah, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes, they're listed as a part of the collections.
Oh, wow. I'd like to go see some of them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You're certainly welcome to.
Repatriation.
So, I might leave very soon, but I'm curious, since we're talking about Africa, the conversation around repatriation in museums, right?
Sure.
So, some of these collections may not have been acquired legally, right? And they end up in museums around the world. What is the conversation around that with the university museum?
Sure. So today, a big part of, and this is actually something that the other curator, Mary, over there, who actually leads, but a big part of what we do today is work on repatriation efforts for our Native American archaeology collections. And so there's something called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990. Mm-hmm. Which requires any institution that receives government funding, like a museum, for instance, to go through the process of fully inventorying their collections and then working with affiliated tribes to repatriate certain materials back to them that are of cultural significance. And so that's a big undertaking that we're working on today, that Mary's been working on for a long time. For international collections, that's another conversation to have for the future. And I know that's something that, and I think, and I don't know if this is, I mean, this is something that you and Mary had talked about.
I don't know as much about that.
So if you there's something you want to speak to with that, you can, but I don't honestly know as much about what happened with that conversation. But yeah, I know that, I mean, that's definitely something that comes up in often in the community. Like, we were talking about the Black Panther movie earlier. And it'll continue to be a big topic, and we'll see where it goes with our collections in particular. Yeah.
So how, with the efforts to reach out to the African American and Native American communities, how far along are you with that?
So our collections encompass primarily the Quapaw, the Osage, and the Caddo tribal nations, and I believe we have completed most for the Caddo and the Osage. And I think so. Mary received a grant to help with these with this process for efforts for the Quapaw right now. So mm-hmm. We're working through it.
Wow, that's good. And I
it's a long process, but a very important process.
Yeah, I noticed that at the Union there is a lot of paintings about Native American history.
Mm-hmm.
Is the museum in charge of those as well?
So, yeah, that was created several years ago, and we do maintain those cases in front of it. So the materials and the cases in front are from the museum. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So, Laurel, you know, we have to say bye to Tony, but I was wondering, you know, there was recent renovation. You guys kind of did a kind of reimagining of the museum in some sense.
We did work on, so are you talking about in our collections in particular? We went through and we anchored our shelving to the floor to make it stable.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that's been going on. And we did an open house earlier in the year mm-hmm. as well, for the community could come out and check out the collections on a larger scale.
It was my understanding that you guys were moving towards doing those kinds of, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. So we did complete the creation of a new strategic plan for the museum, a five-year
right.
plan for the museum back in September. And so efforts with that, there's several priorities. We want to learn how to do better with clarifying our image and our identity in the community so more people know about us and are aware of us and can make use of the resources we can offer. And be able to expand opportunities for students to use the collections as well. So
mm-hmm.
There's a lot on our five-year plan to work towards. It'll keep us busy for the next few years.
Mm-hmm. So the public is welcome inside
the
museum?
Oh, yes. Yes. So, yes, the public is certainly welcome to visit us. You just have to make an appointment. It's totally free. As I mentioned earlier, we started as a student resource. So
mm-hmm.
Students have always been one of our biggest priorities at the museum. So students especially are certainly welcome, but anyone who's interested, you don't even have to be researching anything particular. If you just are interested to come out and see the collections, learn more about what's happening at the museum, you're welcome to make an appointment. We also are going to have an event. We're having Space Night on December 1st.
Oh, tell me more about that.
Yeah, we're partnering with the Space Hogs RSO on campus,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to bring out their mobile planetarium. And then we will have meteorites from the collections on display and some other space-related materials. So, So there's two main curators at the museum, and Mary focuses primarily on collections care and management, and I am all about education and engagement, anything public-facing. So I exist here to raise awareness about us and get more people to come out and see us and find ways for us to support the surrounding community, however that might be. So, yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating. So, how long does it take from when a piece gets into the museum until the public sees it?
Well, it just depends on what exhibits are happening. So
mm-hmm.
most museums in general don't ever display everything at once and like all the time, because I mean we have to balance caring for the collections and making them accessible, and if
mm-hmm.
we have everything out all at once, those collections will decay over time. There'll be light damage and on exposure to light, exposure to humidity and temperature controls, and so but then for us especially, we don't have a traditional public space. And so we have display cases around campus, and we do things like at the public library here. And so it really just depends on what exhibits are coming up. You know, the space night coming up, we have some meteorites that'll be going on display soon. But we also do pop-ups around the community as well on different topics. So, like, we were at the Amazium last week, and we shared some of our natural history collections while they had an owl pellet dissection going on for kids. And so you never know when or what our collections will be will be happening. It's what's, like I mentioned earlier, we have such a varied collection, and we try to make it as accessible as we can. There is a larger effort. So I helped establish a public database for our collections back in May of 2022. And the goal is to have pretty much all of the collections online eventually, but we have over 7 million objects.
Oh, wow.
So it's a large undertaking. So, but that is eventually the goal, is that, you know, you're welcome to come out and see us in person, but if it's 2 a.m. and you're just looking for something to browse online and you fell down the rabbit hole of the museum, you can check out the collections from anywhere. So.
Oh, wonderful. So when, say, a group like the Amazium or class, they just have to reach out to you and you will kind of bring this collection to them to kind of put it on display?
Yeah. It's pretty easy to do. You just reach out, say you're interested in collaborating some way, and we kind of talk through the best ways to do that, make a plan. And sometimes there are limitations on what we can bring, just depending on, you know, if it's a, like, we couldn't bring some of our really delicate taxidermy bird specimens to the Amazium because it's a very hands-on event. Right. The kids, you know, the kids touching a bunch of dead birds, but you know what I'm saying? But in general, we try to be as flexible as we can to make sure that what we do have can be accessed. And sometimes it's gonna be really fun to just table out in the community because you never know who will be stopping by, and kind of a fun thing to happen on both ends.
That is certainly fascinating. So you mentioned the strategic plan, and that plan is to render the museum more visible, and might people, you know, the place where people can hang out, they can study there.
So I would love for that. And we are actually located north of main campus, so we're a bit of a drive, but we do have free parking. So we have free parking.
Where are you exactly?
We are at 2471 North Hatch Avenue. So we're on the Agricultural Extension.
Okay.
Over there by the Don Tyson Building and the Pauline Whitaker Equestrian Center.
Right. Okay. So down there, get into 49.
Yes, exactly. So, but yeah, you're welcome to come out and visit us. But like I said, we don't have a traditional public space at the moment. So a lot of what you see, you can come out and see parts of our archaeology collections. Those are always on display Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. But most of what you can see out there is the collections themselves through a tour, which again is free. So it's not the most traditional experience you might expect when you visit a museum, but I think that a lot of people enjoy it because of that, because it's not just a traditional, okay, I'm going to go see an exhibit. It's seeing behind the scenes of a museum and mm-hmm. being able to ask specific questions. Everybody gets their own tour, basically. You can, you know, we have individuals who come out. We also have classes who come out. We had a class from NWAC who came out last week, mm-hmm. and they were very interested in anything Ozarks, talking about anything Ozarks.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we showed them quite a bit of the collections. We had an archaeologist come out as well to talk about some of the archaeology collections. So,
and my understanding is that there's a kind of agreement or shared leadership with the Archaeological Survey?
We do share the building with them, and we actually care for parts of the survey's collections as well, mm-hmm. Because they also have an archaeology collection from Arkansas. So we work together as needed, and there's plenty of archaeologists in the building we can ask advice and knowledge about.
I imagine the Ozarks collection might be quite popular now, given the show.
Oh, yeah.
What are people asking to see from that?
Well, they were especially interested in local history. So going way back into history before this was the Ozarks, before it was Arkansas, so talking about our archaeology collections. But also the animals of the Ozarks. So seeing our geology and our zoology collections was also of interest to them. They've been learning about this. It was a couple of classes combined, and they were, some of them were learning about forest management. So learning about more of the animals in the area and the geology of the area as well. So it's also just visits like that are a way to, because often people didn't know we existed before that visit. And so it's a way to, it's like a first contact, basically, to get to know us so that they know we're there for any later needs they might have.
Mm-hmm. What is the largest thing you have in the museum, and what is the smallest thing?
That's a good question. Probably the largest thing we have is a fossilized crocodile from Germany. And again, going back to talking about earlier collecting practices, this was something that would have been purchased in the 50s. And like I said, we don't purchase things anymore.
Right.
So it's kind of a random piece, but it's a really special one. It's very well preserved, and people often like to see that on tours. So I'd say that's the largest thing we have. The smallest thing.
You don't have, like, a buffalo or anything like that?
I suppose if we put together some of the skeletons we have in the zoology collections. I mean, we do have an elephant leg. And we have probably the largest bird egg you'll ever see.
Oh, wow.
It's an elephant bird egg. And elephant birds were the largest, so they're extinct now. But they laid the largest eggs in history. So they were even larger than
an ostrich egg.
Yes, yes, right. So, yeah, there's some pretty big pieces there. Probably the smallest thing we have would be some of our mollusk shells, some of our, like, little snail shells, very, very tiny. We have shells from all over the world, hundreds and hundreds of them, and part of like I mentioned with our online database, eventually we'd like to have a representative photo of every single species of animal represented in those collections. And that's a whole other conversation about natural history collections and why those are important. But so, you know, some of those species, like the elephant bird, you're not going to see them anywhere else except for in a museum today, unfortunately.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. But, you know, Just thinking about, you know, as it relates to Africans and African Americans, and why, you know, these kinds of experiences are very important, right? When we're talking about Africa and African Americans, we're talking about people with rich cultural, linguistic, and, you know, ethnic diversity, right? If you look across the United States and the diaspora and the continent, right? So, you know, when people tend to, you know, Africa is not a country, mm-hmm. it's a continent. And so looking at different objects that might go from East Africa, maybe Tanzania, all the way back to West Africa or North Africa, right, can help a lot in terms of what people understand about that Africa is not one thing.
Right.
And it's not set in history and just remain unchanged. Mm-hmm. That it also evolves. And when you see that through the objects, you know, I think it helps to kind of, you know, minimize some of those stereotypes mm-hmm. that people might have, right? That Africans, just like other people in the world, you know, are always having shifts to their social, cultural, and political, their environmental conditions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right. When I think about the museum, I think about that as a space that can depict those kinds of things.
Most definitely. And that's why we love having classes and students and researchers come out to study these and share that with the community and give that context to them, I think is really, really important, most definitely.
Mm-hmm. So should, if other members of the public have these kinds of things that they also want to make a part of the collection, should they reach out to you all?
Yes, definitely. You're welcome to reach out and talk with us about what you're interested in donating. We'd love to expand our African and African American study, our African American collections, most definitely.
Oh, great. Well, there you have it. If you do have something that you think is museum worthy, please do reach out to the University of Arkansas Museum, especially one of their lead curators, Ms. Laura Lamb, to get that a part of the collection. And we do invite you, too, to go and visit the museum.
And I just want to add to that. I always tell people whenever we're talking about things that are museum worthy that don't ever underestimate what you might have.
Exactly.
You never know because, I mean, talking about the dolls earlier. Dolls, when you think dolls, you think toys. Mm-hmm. You don't think it's really that significant. But obviously, they can be very significant. Everyday items can be very significant.
Absolutely.
And tell you a lot about the era they come from and the era that you're in today. So I just always tell people never to underestimate what you might have and why it might be important.
Or your role in history.
Right, of course.
You too can play a great role in history. Well, Laurel, it's certainly, has been great fun having you here today and you educating us about what's available at the University of Arkansas Museum. Thank you so much for coming to Undisciplined.
Thank you so much, too. It's been great to hear your thoughts and learn more about what you've had to say as well. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined. This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Carnesia Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African African American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African American Studies Program and the Undisciplined Podcast on Instagram at UARK_AAST or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you liked today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.